This is NewsHour on the BBC World Service. Coming to you live from London, I'm Regini Vaidyanathan. As we head into the final weekend of campaigning before the US election, it's all going to come down to the contest in a handful of states which are still too close to call. Well, one of them is Wisconsin, and NewsHour's James Kumarasamy is there.
Thanks, Regini. I'm in Milwaukee, the biggest, most populous city in this swingiest of Midwestern swing states. And sporting fans will know it's home to the Bucks and the Brewers. Well, later today, it will host both Donald Trump and Kamala Harris. The Republican and Democratic nominees have been crisscrossing this huge country, but this evening they are holding events in Milwaukee, just 15 minutes' drive from each other. It's a stop on what's being called a blue wall blitz, with both camps focusing on the trio of previously true blue Democratic states that flipped to Donald Trump in 2016 and back to Joe Biden in 2020. Victory in all three would almost certainly secure a Harris presidency. Lose one and her path becomes far more precarious. Well, Donald Trump's currently in another blue wall state, Michigan. He's been to the city of Dearborn, home to the largest Arab American population, trying to prize more of those voters away from the Democrats because of their dissatisfaction with the Biden administration's approach to the war in the Middle East.
You're going to have peace. You're going to have peace in the Middle East. And they should have peace in the Middle East, but not with the clowns you have in the Middle East. Let me tell you, what you have people in the Middle East that aren't doing their job, and you have people in the U.S. that aren't doing their job, and when they get it together, when they get it right, you're going to have peace in the Middle East.
But Mr. Trump has been facing criticism for other war-related comments he made during an earlier campaign event about the former Republican Congresswoman Liz Cheney, who's now a supporter of Kamala Harris.
She's a radical war hawk. Let's put her with a rifle standing there with nine barrels shooting at her, okay? Let's see how she feels about it. You know, when the guns are trained on her face.
The Democratic nominee addressed those comments when she spoke to reporters on the tarmac ahead of her visit to Wisconsin.
He has increased his violent rhetoric, Donald Trump has, about political opponents, and in great detail, suggested rifles should be trained on former Representative Liz Cheney. This must be disqualifying. Anyone who wants to be president of the United States who uses that kind of violent rhetoric is clearly disqualified and unqualified to be president.
The Trump-supporting news network Fox is calling all of this a smear. Well, in a few moments, we'll get a briefing on the state of play here in Wisconsin, carried by both Trump and Biden by less than 1%. First, though, let's hear from the third blue wall state, Pennsylvania. Like Milwaukee, where Joe Biden got nearly 80% in the last election, the city of Philadelphia is heavily Democratic. And Justin Webb begins his report in Philly's culinary heartland.
Give me a pepper tree, Webb.
We're outside Pat's King of Steaks. They invented the prototype of beefsteak sandwiches that uses an Italian-style roll and seasonings. Just to give you a sense of what they are selecting for their lunch, one of them called the Originator, but another called the Heart Attack.
Here's your pepper, cheese, and onions.
I am Frank Enrico Oliveri. I am the fourth-generation owner of the world-famous Pat's King of Steaks in South Philadelphia. Former President Donald Trump was here. We got the word that he was coming the day before, and there was really nothing we could do to stop him.
Well, of course, my mother's a Trumpster. She's delusional.
Don't even let me say it.
We look over politics.
We don't have a choice.
Do you ever talk about politics?
No, we don't. It's his prerogative who he votes for. It's my prerogative who I vote for.
We are in the kitchen,
and it's all stainless steel, and there's a lot going on. It's busy. Tell me about costs.
The meat's gone up probably like 25 to 35% since the pandemic. And our rolls have gone up maybe 35%, 40%.
And what's that done to the prices you charge people?
Unfortunately, we have to pass the prices along to our customers now.
But it's those extra costs that are hurting Kamala Harris, isn't it? Because they associate the inflation with this administration, and she's a part of the administration.
Yeah, she's a part of the administration, absolutely. And everybody associates what's wrong with the current administration and totally forgets about what the previous administration did to cause what's going on in this administration.
Right, hey, we come out from the kitchen, out to the red benches, very basic red benches outside, and let's talk to some diners. We're talking to people about the election, not necessarily who you're voting for, but what you think the issues are. You can tell us.
We are from Boston,
right?
Here volunteering for the Harris campaign for the next week, so we're excited. We start the door knocking and phone calls and whatever they want us to do tomorrow through Election Day.
Looking at the streets around here where people are living lives that are kind of paycheck to paycheck.
Yeah.
What are the issues they bring up with you?
The economy. It has to be. It's number one. I do know every time we talk to a Trump supporter, they say it's immigration. So when you're looking around and you see these diverse neighborhoods, it's always shocking that people are voting for Trump when in fact it's going to probably affect them more than anybody else.
Ladies, I'll let you get on with your steak. Thank you.
Thank you.
You got a view that you'll share with us?
Very simple. I hate the professional political class in this country. They don't have any real-world experience. The only thing they care about is getting elected, getting reelected, amassing power, maintaining that power, and getting elected again.
So if you believe those things, who do you vote for?
I vote for Trump, because he's coming from the real world.
Here's the thing about Pennsylvania. No Democratic presidential nominee has won the White House without winning this state since 1948. It is a must-win for Kamala Harris. And to win this state, she has to win this city, Philadelphia, by a huge blowout margin. Can she do it? We've come outside the center of the city now to a suburb, a trendy suburb. It's Fishtown. It's a very democratic area in its politics. A lot of young families living here, and among them, Julia Taruso, who is the political reporter for the Philadelphia Inquirer.
For a long, long time, the way you won as a Democrat in Pennsylvania was to drive turnout up in Philadelphia, get all your voters out there and in Pittsburgh and some of the suburbs, and a Democrat could win Pennsylvania.
Well, what is it that hasn't cut through to those communities she ought to be cutting through to? Is it possible to say what it is?
Well, in Philadelphia specifically, we are still, unfortunately, the poorest big city in America. So nationally, the big issue in this campaign is the economy, and in Philadelphia and in Pennsylvania, that's the case for voters, too.
And Donald Trump is aware of that. Has he been working? I mean, you've made it plain, this city is a Democratic city, but has the Trump campaign in Philadelphia been trying to just pull away enough voters who would in the past have voted Democratic to make the crucial difference?
The Trump campaign has had the biggest footprint in Philadelphia that a Republican campaign has had in years and years and years. Now, that's not to say he's here all the time. He did one big rally here over the summer. It's not as big as the Democrats by any means, but they are here. You know, I think the hope for them is that even if some of those voters don't come out and vote for Trump, they might stay home, and that helps Trump here.
We've hopped in a car now to cross Philadelphia to go to one of the few areas of the city that you can honestly say is a Republican stronghold. And the reason we're going there is to hear from Republicans themselves about the degree of confidence they have that Trump really is doing some business in this city that'll make a difference.
My name is Joseph Accavino.
And you're going to be a Trump voter?
Yes, sir.
You've got a Trump cap on?
Yep, Trump Vance.
Why?
The economy, the way people are feeling, the way everything is. Most people, you know, can't afford to live right now. Can't afford rent, can't afford gas, can't afford the food you eat, the clothes you put on your back, you know. 2016, the economy was well under Trump. Biden came in, Harris came in, crushed it, highest inflation rate, destroyed everything. And then now, you know, Trump's going to have to come back in and fix what Harris and Biden failed to do.
Josh Novotny, I'm a partner at SBL Strategies, which is a lobbying firm based out of D.C., but I live in Philadelphia, and I'm a local ward leader and involved with politics. The neighborhood's called Packer Park. It's one of the few wards in Philadelphia that actually has a Republican majority for most elections.
And how's it doing as a campaign place for you this time around?
Yeah, it's actually a hotbed for Trump. It is extremely lively for Trump, enthusiastic, and we have tons of early data showing it's going to be heavy turnouts.
So this city, we keep coming back to this city. Yeah. She's going to win this city.
She'll win
but,
the city.
But your point is, by how much?
Correct. So an old campaign hat like myself, who's been in a few statewide Pennsylvania war rooms on election night, the first county to come in, for the most part, is Philadelphia. And it's a gut punch for Republicans. You're down 400,000 or 500,000 votes to start off the evening. Now, if you can shave that down by 20,000, 30,000, 40,000 votes, that makes the rest of the night a lot easier.
20, 30, 40. I mean, it's not many votes, is it?
No. He won the state by 30 or 40,000. No, I think it was less than that in 2016, and he lost by a little bit over 80,000 in 2020.
And this huge nation with whatever it is now, 340 million people in it, actually really coming down to tens of thousands of people in this one city.
Yeah, in probably the ward we're in right now.
Justin Webb reporting from Philadelphia there. And yes, if the polls are right, the margins could well be small. Although here in Wisconsin, we have to say the opinion polls weren't exactly on the money in the last two presidential elections, underestimating the Trump vote by up to 7 points. The state's most respected pollster, Charles Franklin from Marquette Law School, did rather better than most. And I asked him what the key issues are for Wisconsin voters this year.
The key thing we've seen all year long is that people rate the economy as the most important problem, and they say Trump will do a better job than Harris by about 10 percentage points in this final poll. Second top issue is abortion policy, which favors Harris considerably, and the third is immigration and the border, the southern border, which favors Trump.
Both candidates are spending a lot of time here in this closing week. What do you think their goal is?
At this point, I think it is maximize your turnout. 5% say they're undecided at this point. But the one that I think Harris does seem to be targeting are Republicans who have an unfavorable view of Donald Trump. These are the folks that didn't vote for him in the primaries. They're conflicted about him. So I think this last outreach to disgruntled Republicans does have a reason to go there to try to convince these folks that their dislike of Trump is enough to bring them to vote for a Democrat. But that is a heavy hurdle for most partisans to cross over.
So, Charles, last question, possibly unfair. How are you calling this?
I think this is a race that's so close that it would be no surprise if Donald Trump wins, and it would be no surprise if Kamala Harris wins. What would be a big surprise is if either of them wins by 3 points or more.
Wisconsin pollster Charles Franklin. And as we heard from him and from Justin in Philadelphia, the economy is top of voters' concerns, or perhaps more accurately, it's a cost of living. And we've just uploaded a bonus edition of the NewsHour podcast looking at that very issue here in the state of Wisconsin. It also includes some great facts about badgers and butter. So go to wherever you get your podcasts and you will find it there. You're listening to NewsHour from the BBC World Service with Rajini Vaidyanathan in London and me, James Kamarasamy, in Milwaukee.
Coming up, with more than 200 people now dead from the flooding in Valencia in Spain, did the local government ignore weather warnings which could have alerted residents much sooner?
The message from the regional government was, it might be getting a little rough out there, but things are going to die down relatively quickly. He did not tell businesses to close. He did not urge people to stay home. And so many people were actually kept at their workplaces until well after it was possible for them to safely make it home. Basically, the roads were flooded outside.
Let's take a look at some of the headlines. The heads of a number of UN agencies have described conditions in Gaza as apocalyptic after weeks of an Israeli offensive against Hamas. And Donald Trump's in Dearborn, Michigan, the largest Arab-majority city in the US, where he hopes to attract support from Arab-American voters. This is Rajini Vaidyanathan with NewsHour, coming to you live from London. Now to Gaza. And the World Health Organization says a second round of polio vaccinations for children in the north of the territory will resume this weekend after delays caused by Israeli attacks in the area. Speaking at a news briefing, the head of the WHO, Tedros Ghebreyesus, warned that their efforts won't be enough to make sure all children are vaccinated.
The humanitarian pause necessary to conduct the campaign has been assured, but the area of the pause has been substantially reduced and is now limited to just Gaza City.
Well, Joe English is the emergency communications specialist at UNICEF, and he told me more about the plan to resume the vaccination campaign.
It is
absolutely critical that we're able to reach these children. As Dr. Tedros said, unfortunately now this has been limited to just Gaza City, which means that there are around 15,000 children under the age of 10, we estimate, in towns like Jabalia, Beit Lahia, Beit Hanun, who actually still remain inaccessible to us and we will be missed by this campaign. And obviously this compromises its effectiveness. And if we're going to actually interrupt the poliovirus transmission and stop the possibility of it mutating and posing a threat to more children, not just in Gaza, but across the region, we have to reach at least 90% of all children. So tomorrow is going to be a good start. We've got more than 200 teams in 106 fixed sites who will be doing these vaccinations, but we have to be able to reach these last 15,000 children. And the only way that we're going to be able to do that is a ceasefire, a real pause in the fighting to allow us to get into these cities that have been under siege for almost a month now and reach these children.
Until that is the case, what assurances have you had from Israel about being able to resume the vaccination campaign as is?
Yeah, you know, we've received those assurances that the pauses will be respected. We saw in the first round what is possible when that does happen. But it also, you know, what's absolutely critical is to have the trust of the mums and the dads who are going to be the ones who are bringing their kids to be vaccinated, because it can't just be, you know, a pause for one day. We have to see multiple days so that, you know, people who may be scared or who for whatever reason can't get there on the first day can get there on a second day. And this, you know, the proof is always in the pudding with these things. We have to see a pause in the fighting tomorrow. If that happens, then yes, we hope we can reach a significant number of children who we still need to reach with this second dose. But as I say, if we're going to reach all of them, we need to be able to access the children in the far north of the strip as well.
And just tell us about your health work on the ground at the moment. What are the other greatest needs for children at the moment, particularly in northern Gaza?
Yeah, I mean, as I say, like the you know, a number of the heads of UN agencies today called the situation apocalyptic, and that really is, you know, strong words, but it is true. You know, we are seeing children and families who are in need of everything. We continue to see mass casualty events where large numbers of children are being killed and injured and then rushed to hospitals where, if they're lucky, there may be a single surgeon, there may be a single pediatrician, but they don't have, you know, the supplies, the medicine, the medical supplies that they need to be able to treat children. WHO, our colleagues managed to get up to Kamal Adwan Hospital and deliver supplies. And then 2 or 3 days later, there was an attack and those supplies were destroyed and damaged. And so it is absolutely catastrophic. And it is another reason why we just have to see an end to this fighting. We have to see a pause in the fighting and a ceasefire and the hostages released.
That's Joe English from UNICEF there. Now, let me take you to the forests of Ecuador. Well, that's the Song of the Cedars, which uses audio recordings from the Los Cedros cloud forest. It's one of the most biodiverse habitats in the world and a protected reserve. Well, that song was written by a group of musicians who argue that the forest itself should be officially credited as one of the songwriters. They've actually petitioned the copyright authorities in Ecuador to recognise Los Cedros as a co-author. Well, Cosmo Sheldrake composed the song. So how did he come up with it?
So the song emerged over a period of time when we were on a field trip in Los Cedros and we were camping up in the high cloud forest. We'd gone to explore to try and find the watershed of the Los Cedros River. And then just we were sitting around and Rob started writing fragments of lyrics that were kind of popping into his mind. And then I discovered I had an app on my phone and I never used it and allowed me to record and layer up my voice. And so incorporating a few field recordings I've been making while on the trip, and this song kind of emerged.
So should we call you the composer, though, or the forest?
Well, I think the point we're trying to argue is just that this song would never have happened in any way, shape or form without the forest. And so it's truly a kind of collaborative project, really, between the four of us present and the forest itself.
And what is so important about the forest in terms of the fabric of the music? I mean, there's all kinds of different birds, insects, other kind of sounds in there that we were trying to pick out. Just tell us more about that.
So it kind of starts at dawn and works through some recordings of, nighttime. It has some recordings of some bats echolocating and then some howler monkeys and then the dawn chorus and then slowly kind of works into the afternoon. So it's a transition between night and day, really, the field recordings.
And of course, one of the reasons we're talking to you is because you've petitioned the copyright authorities in Ecuador to recognise the forest itself as a co-author of the music. Just tell me what exactly you've done then and where that case is at the moment.
So we've submitted to the copyright authority in Ecuador that we're asking for them to recognise the moral authorship of the Los Cedros Cloud Forest as a co-creator of the song.
Well, what is moral authorship, if I may ask, Cosmo?
So moral authorship, basically, it's just a recognition of you were involved in the creation of a work of art or a piece, music in this case. And it's different from economic rights, for example. We're not asking them to recognize intellectual property, for example, just the simple fact that the forest was present and inseparable from the creative process. So moral authorship can't be bought or sold, like, for example, a financial right or royalty claim. So we're not asking for the recognition of the Los Cedros to own royalties that could be then traded or bought, but just to acknowledge the inalienable presence of something that can't be separated.
I mean, I'm not trying to sound flippant here, Cosmo, but I mean, so you're not trying to, you know, get money for the frogs or the bats or whatever, for them to kind of, you know, preservation or anything like that. So some people would say, well, what is the point of this then? Because normally when you talk about music rights and copyright, it's about money, isn't it?
Well, so all royalties made will be going back to the Los Cedros Fund.
Yeah, so they will go to the frogs.
100%, yeah. And no, so any money made is definitely going back to Los Cedros, the Los Cedros Fund. It's just that we're not petitioning the courts to recognise the intellectual property ownership of the forest.
Is there a wider issue here then about the recognition of nature in creative processes?
For me, yes. You know, as slowly but surely as people are finding out more and more, for example, in the world of cetacean research, where Project SETI, for example, is figuring out how to translate sperm whale communications into English or human. And, you know, with people studying bird language and the sophistication of some of that and how much it's a cultural phenomenon and socially acquired and all this sorts of stuff. It just seems to me that the more we discover about the complexities and sophistication of the music and language of many animals, it's kind of just updating some of the slightly more old-fashioned legal understandings that haven't yet recognised some of this more contemporary sort of ecology.
That's Cosmo Sheldrake speaking to me from Colombia. Well, let's have a listen to a bit more of his composition.
Earth, cover my limbs now. Mold, thrive on my skin. Earth, cover my limbs now. Mold, thrive on my skin.
Welcome back to NewsHour. The UN's Refugee Agency has praised Thailand's decision to help nearly 500,000 stateless people become citizens. A UN spokesperson said it would be the most dramatic reduction in statelessness that the world had ever seen. The BBC World Service's Asia-Pacific editor Michael Bristow has more.
Well, what the Thai government has decided to do is they've decided to bring forward a pathway for 600,000 stateless people living in Thailand for them eventually to become citizens. It's going to take some time. They're going to have a clean bill of health when it comes to a criminal record. They're going to have to declare an oath of loyalty. But after 5 years, they're going to get citizenship. This is an extraordinary amount of people, really, 600,000 people in Thailand. And you might be asking who they are. They're a group of people, essentially. They're a lot of hill tribes live in Thailand on the border with Myanmar. They've lived in Thailand for a long time or across the border. They're known about, but they're essentially stateless. There are other ethnic minorities as well. Right down in the south in the islands, there are seafaring nomads who are living on the fringes of society as well. There are also a group of people who have come to Thailand from neighbouring countries, often displaced by war, Myanmar again, but also Laos, Cambodia. Many of those have been living in Thailand for decades, really. They're known about, but they just haven't been made citizens until now.
As we know, in many other parts of the world, the idea of giving people who are stateless citizenship of a country can be politically controversial. How is this going down in Thailand?
The main people who it's going to affect is the people who are going to get citizenship for once, because Of course, there's a whole range of things, if you imagine, that they can't do. They can't access education, they can't get a bank account, they can't. Health becomes more expensive when they become ill. So these people, it's a matter of their, you know, their futures are completely changed. The United Nations Refugee Agency as well, it's really welcomed this. In fact, the representative from the organisation in Thailand said this is the biggest reduction in statelessness that the world has ever seen. You know, 500,000 or so people, and there are millions more people without a statehood across the world. But Thailand did have a sizable population, so this is going to make a real big dent in that number.
And has there been any resistance to it then, or has it been broadly welcomed politically?
I think the Thai government for a few years has recognised that this is the right thing to do. So they've signed up to the UN Refugee Agency's agenda to try and end this problem. So I think that's one aspect of it. Another aspect of it is economics. You know, the Thai economy isn't doing as well as it has done in the past. And they recognise that these people are hardworking people, Thais, to all intents and purposes. They've lived in Thailand for many years. Bringing them into the system allows them to pay taxes and also allows them to benefit the economy. So from a practical point of view, as well as a theoretical and a kindness point of view, it makes sense.
That's the BBC's Michael Bristow there. You're listening to NewsHour from the BBC World Service. I'm Rajini Vaidyanathan. More than 200 people are now known to have died in flash floods in eastern Spain, making it Europe's worst weather disaster for five decades. Almost 2,000 people remain unaccounted for. Many of them are in Valencia, where rapidly rising waters left people trapped in their houses, vehicles and workplaces earlier in the week. More bad weather could be on the way. The authorities have extended a red weather alert for torrential rain on the southern coast around Huelva. Bethany Bell reports from Valencia.
Streets and parts of the city and many surrounding towns bear the scars of the devastation brought by torrential rain on Tuesday night. Mud caked on roads, pavements and buildings, overturned cars littering the streets. The entrance to one road tunnel here is completely blocked, with four rows of cars piled on top of each other. With many people still missing, there's a strong sense of shock and anger. In the village of Aldaya, we met Juan González, who's an English teacher. He told us the local authorities had failed his community.
It's a mix of anger and sadness. Sadness because, obviously, all this, you know, people that are not here have gone through a terrible agony to, until they died. Sorry. They passed away. And anger because it's outrageous that our local government didn't do anything about it, knowing they well knew that, you know, this was coming and did nothing about it.
Volunteers out in force, battling the mud with brooms and spades. Some have walked long distances across roads blocked to cars to try to help with the clean-up. Valencia's regional president, Carlos Mazón, said more troops would be deployed.
We have requested additional army troops for tomorrow. They've been on the move since 8 o'clock today, and tomorrow, in principle, there will be another 500. As we continue assessing the situation, the needs are being integrated to give the army the task, the work, and the needs to be handled.
Outside food distribution centres, people are queuing up for supplies. Monica, a volunteer, said she felt compelled to come and help.
I came here to help anything they could need, cleaning, coming with the supplies, water, clothes, oil, anything that they can need. All the cleaning supplies also, bath, shower, everything. I need to come and help them. They need everything.
Many people here are worried for their family and friends. One local mayor warned that many of the upturned vehicles on the streets could have people trapped inside them.
That's Bethany Bell reporting from Valencia there. Well, the floods hit on Tuesday, but how early was the local autonomous government warned? And how quick were they to react? Well, I thought Hernandez Morales and his colleagues at Politico have been reporting on the timeline of events. How early did that warning come?
As early as last week, we had warnings from Spain's National Meteorological Agency, the AEMET, which issued an official warning on October 25th. So that was last Friday, warning that potentially historic rains were heading to the area. And that note, you know, continued to be issued with greater intensity with every day that passed by, to the point where on Monday, the agency issued an orange weather warning for several regions, amongst them Valencia. And that afternoon, that warning was raised even higher, so that when we get to Tuesday morning, so that the day of the floods, the first thing that the AEMET does is issue a bulletin at 8 a.m. warning of extreme danger throughout the region. From the very start, this national agency was very much sounding the alarm and even telling people through its social media that they should stay indoors, that they should avoid unnecessary travel. But of course, the key thing to keep in mind here is that in Spain, the autonomous communities, so the regions, are the ones with the mandate to handle all civil protection and emergency services. The national government cannot intervene. National agencies cannot intervene. So ultimately, it was up to the regional government to take action.
And in particular, the regional president, Carlos Mezon, who would have had ultimate responsibility. And yet your article points out that he really was carrying on with his regular schedule.
Indeed, it was really quite shocking to us as we went through the timeline, simply because it was clear that many people in the region itself were well aware of the danger. And one of the examples that we cite is that the University of Valencia on Monday ends up canceling classes and declaring a state of emergency and sending everyone home. But on Tuesday morning, so just as the AEMET is sending out this national bulletin warning of extreme danger, you almost simultaneously get the official agenda for the president of that day issued. And the agenda is, you know, business as usual. Rather remarkably, President Mason didn't cancel any of these interviews. He just carried on, even though he was clearly receiving news of what was going on. Mm-hmm. He even mentioned it at 1 p.m. in a press conference, which also surprised us quite a bit, because he appeared and, you know, mentioned that, yes, that there were heavy rains. But then he told the media that the forecasts indicated that the rains would be moving on to another region, at which point really the effects would decrease dramatically
and
in Valencia.
This is the thing I wanted to really ask you about. You're basically mm-hmm. saying that he downplayed the severity of those warnings, saying that the intensity was likely to decrease.
Indeed. And this is really quite surprising to us, because at the same time, we know that even the regional delegation for the AEMET, for the National Meteorological Agency, was already confirming that rivers were overflowing. Indeed, the Júcar Hydrographic Confederation, which oversees the rivers in that area, was also already posting images of flooding. So it really is quite remarkable that at the moment, you know, the message from the regional government was it might be getting a little rough out there, but things are going to die down relatively quickly. He did not tell businesses to close. He did not urge people to stay home. And so many people were actually kept at their workplaces until well after it was possible for them to safely make it home. By the time they tried to leave their desks, basically the roads were flooded outside.
Does this demonstrate that particular region and Valencia was just unprepared for this? I mean, why did the regional government not heed those warnings more seriously?
Yeah, so there are definitely two takeaways here. One is that Valencia, in particular for this disaster, seems to just have not been prepared, or at least not done enough to warn people to stick to higher ground to get home. One of the things that we really highlight is that the first emergency text message that the region's inhabitants receive is at 8:12 p.m. And this is at a time where we know that many people were already flooded at their homes. So it just came too late for people to evacuate. But I would also stress that Valencia is emblematic of something that we're seeing all over Europe and indeed the world, which is our cities are just not prepared for the climate disasters that are coming.
That's Politico's Aitor Hernandez Morales. On Sunday, it will be 2 years since a peace deal put an end to one of the deadliest civil wars Africa has seen in recent years. More than 500,000 people were estimated to have died in a conflict between Ethiopia's central government and fighters loyal to the breakaway region of Tigray. Well, today, despite the end of the war, Ethiopia is still not at peace. In the Amhara region, violence continues on, and in Tigray itself, the impact of the war lingers. The BBC's Kalkidan Yulbeltal sent us this report.
The streets of Mekele, the capital of Tigray in the north of Ethiopia, have come back to life. Shops have reopened, cafes are busy, but this is a very different picture from the last time that I was here. Between 2020 and 2022, allied Ethiopian and Eritrean soldiers battled local Tigrayan fighters on these streets. The African Union estimates that more than 500,000 people were killed during the conflict. Lack of food deliveries and the destruction of medical facilities triggered a severe humanitarian crisis. At the height of the war, reportedly more than 5 million people needed urgent food assistance, while 1.7 million had been forced to leave their homes. Eventually, in November 2022, a peace deal was struck.
It's a major breakthrough. Ethiopia's government has called it monumental. Rebels have agreed to disarm.
Guns fell silent, but for some people in Tigray, the dangers of the war still persist.
I was near my home when I saw some sheep and walked towards them. All of a sudden, an explosion threw me far away.
17-year-old Brahana Haile is a student from a Tigrayan village close to the border with Eritrea. Last year, he stepped on an exploded ordnance near his home and lost one of his legs and parts of his hands.
It was loud and very painful. There was blood everywhere. And then I heard people screaming.
2 years since the end of the war, some areas of Tigray are still littered with unexploded weapons. Since 2023, the International Red Cross says it has assisted nearly 400 victims of such horrific accidents. 80% of them are children who often lose their limbs after touching the undetonated ordnance. Negesti, a mother of one, lost her husband, a farmer, in an explosion of ordnance that was left uncollected.
He went out to work on a building. On his way back, an explosion hit him. We took him to the hospital, but he died the same day. I was 5 months pregnant at that time. After that, the village helped us with food.
Very little money is available for demining Tigray. Local officials do their best to train residents on how to identify and safely collect unexploded devices. But it's a dangerous endeavor. Haddish Garhamedin is a police chief in Gararo village.
We have reported up, but there's little support coming our way. We are very concerned about these explosives.
A fragile peace has settled in Tigray. And for students like Brahana, there is now a chance to improve their own lives and that of their families.
I have mixed feelings. Sometimes I get angry, and sometimes I realize that I am alive. It used to take me 20 minutes to walk from home to school. Now it takes me about 50 minutes just to get there. So I moved to the nearest Adwa town with my elder sister, who is displaced from Western Tigray.
Despite the improvements, there are still issues. Nearly 1 million people remain displaced and are still dependent on aid. Tigrayan forces themselves have not fully disarmed, and violent border clashes keep redrawing regional boundaries. Formally, peace has been made, but many Tigrayans are still suffering from the aftershocks of war.
That's the BBC's Kalkidan Yulbeltal reporting there. This is NewsHour, coming to you live from London with me, Regina Vaidyanathan. This is Regina Vaidyanathan with NewsHour, coming to you live from London. Well, let's return to our main story, and that is, of course, the US presidential election. Well, as we were saying earlier in the programme, the Republican nominee, Donald Trump, is holding a rally in Dearborn, Michigan, which is a state crucial for both candidates. Well, our correspondent, Ione Wells, is at the rally, and she joins us now. First of all, Ione, what's Mr. Trump been saying?
Well, Trump's rally is actually here in Macomb County, but he did visit Dearborn earlier. He has been addressing his loyal supporters, speaking about some of his economic plans, particularly stressing his America First policy. A lot of this campaign in the next couple of days is really about trying to rally his core supporters to actually turn out and vote for him, but also try and convince some of those still undecided voters, especially now that tens of millions of people in America have already cast their ballot in this election. But he was in Dearborn earlier, which is the largest Arab majority city in the US, and that was really significant, I think, because when you walk around Dearborn and speak to people, you hear a lot of anger at the Democrats at the moment, a lot of anger about how the Democrats have handled the conflict in the Middle East. And that is something that I think Trump was trying to respond to specifically. He told one business where he was campaigning that what he wanted in the Middle East was peace. And that is a narrative which I think has really kind of trickled down to some people on the streets there.
And what's Mr. Trump's message been then regarding the Middle East?
Yeah, that's that. Well, he hasn't actually said how he would bring peace to the Middle East. He's not said how he would end the war, only that he says that he would. He is a very close ally of President Benjamin Netanyahu in Israel. He has said, for example, that he would deport some pro-Palestinian protesters, for example. So some might think that he actually is someone who's been very critical of the Palestinian cause. But actually, when you walk around Dearborn, a lot of people have heard that message that he wants to end the war and translated that as he is a candidate that will bring peace. They contrast that to what they have seen from Kamala Harris and from Joe Biden over the last year, which they argue is essentially their taxpayers' money being used to fund the Israeli war effort, which is something that they are incredibly angry about, as I say. Now, there are sort of mixed reactions in that community about how to respond. Some are saying that they may just protest as a result and vote for a third-party candidate, somebody like the Green Party's Jill Stein, or not vote at all. Others are saying that they will lend their vote to Donald Trump. Others still are saying that they would vote for Kamala Harris, but some, I think, quite reluctantly. There was one Arab American I spoke to who said that he was going to vote for Kamala Harris, but has received a big backlash in his community for doing so. So I think one thing is really clear, that that community in Dearborn is very, very divided, as the whole state of Michigan is.
Yes, and you're right. Donald Trump is very close to Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Just briefly, just remind us why Macomb County is such an important one. It's one of those swing counties, isn't it?
Well, Macomb County, as you say, is really important in this election. It was previously and historically Democrat. It's got a large blue-collar sort of workforce, very unionized as an area, traditionally quite Democrat in its economic values. But in 2016, it flipped to Donald Trump, who appealed, I think, to a lot of, for example, auto industry workers who maybe were unhappy at the collapse of that industry in some places, globalization more generally, some of Trump's economic policies, especially around things like introducing tariffs on international trade, really spoke, I think, to certain voters in Macomb County. It has consistently then, since 2016, voted for the Republicans, voted for Donald Trump, and I think he is hoping, especially speaking to crowds here this evening, to try and get that vote out for him again here.
Okay, Ione Wells in Michigan for us. Thanks very much for bringing us up to date on the latest on the election there. Now, a Japanese cultural icon is turning 50.
Hello, Kitty, play with us today.
Her face has been on makeup, aircraft, stationery, bank cards, high fashion and high street fashion, TV shows and video games. All of it worth billions. Well, we are, of course, talking about Hello Kitty, the small white cat without a mouth who has a red bow on one of her ears. Well, she is, of course, a global pop culture icon designed in 1974 by the artist Yuko Shimizu for the company Sanrio, But how did she become such a big household name? Well, Christine Yarno is the author of Pink Globalisation, Hello Kitty's Trek Across the Pacific. When I spoke to her earlier, I admitted to her that I was a Hello Kitty fan. But for those listeners who are wondering what the fuss is all about, what would she say about why Hello Kitty is just so special?
Well, you know, and thank you so much for this phone call. I really appreciate talking about Hello Kitty once again, you know, now that she's 50 years old. I think what makes Hello Kitty so special is that she is the kind of flexibility and that the company has given her. You know, of course, there's a beautiful design involved, a beautiful, elegant design that pares away a lot of the detail. And what you're left with is this kind of blank slate that a lot of people look at, and the immediate reaction is, oh, how cute, right? And you know, as a fan. And that cuteness, though, I feel kind of gives you an entree into people's hearts. It sounds a bit highfalutin, but into emotions, into the possibilities of empathy, and into care. And so it's cuteness that becomes the inroad, I think, to and really the key to her popularity.
And her cuteness has endured decades. I have been a Hello Kitty lover, shall we say, for 40 years, since I was a really young child. Yeah. And actually, she's kind of grown. She's become not just this cute little character who's on pencil cases when I was at school, but she's now, you know, generates billions of dollars.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And that was, you know, the thing is, what's interesting to me is that when I studied this, I realized that, you know, Hello Kitty was always meant to be global. I mean, think of the name. This is not, you know, Ohayo Sawako-chang or anything. It's not a Japanese name. It's English, Hello Kitty, but not regular English, because we wouldn't say good morning, Betty, or something. So, you know, just the Hello Kitty becomes a kind of what's been called Japlish, where you put English words together in a particular kind of configuration that might be more linked to Japanese. So Hello Kitty itself meant to be global, meant to be very direct, very cute, and as you recognize, has grown into this global position.
Christine, we've only got about 30 seconds, but how much has she been an ambassador for Japan? I mean, I might admit on air right now, I've actually traveled to Japan and been to Hello Kitty World.
Absolutely. If you believe in soft power, if you believe in the power of something being able to influence people, then I say Hello Kitty has soft power, and that label is Japanese.
Christine Yarno, author of Pink Globalization, ending our conversation about Hello Kitty and this edition of NewsHour. Thanks for listening.